thank you for tuning in to episode 142 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.FM, or download the program after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. We have a long interview this week, so let's dig in, and yes, you will find out that's a pun. Michael Abelman is an American-Canadian, an author, organic farmer, educator, and advocate for sustainable agriculture. He's been farming organically since the early 1970s and is considered one of the pioneers of the organic farming and urban agricultural movements. He's a frequent lecturer to audiences all over the world and the winner of numerous awards for his work. He's the author of 4 published books, From the Good Earth, A Celebration of Growing Food Around the World, On Good Land, The Autobiography of an Urban Farm, Fields of Plenty, A Farmer's Journey in Search of Real Food and the People Who Grow It, and most recently, Street Farm, Growing Foods, Jobs, and Hopes on the Urban Frontier. I met Michael recently at a fundraiser for the farm that is the subject of this book. He was the founder of the Center for Urban Agriculture at Fairview Gardens in Goleta, California, where he farmed for 20 years. He's co-founder and director of Soul Food Street Farms and of the charity Cultivate Canada in Vancouver, Canada, and founder and director of the Center for Arts, Ecology, and Agriculture based at his family home and farm on Salt Spring Island, which is called Foxglove Farm. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hey, so nice to be with you.
Yes. Well, thank you for joining me again. So you spell Soul Food Farms, S-O-L-E. What's the significance behind the name of this farm?
Yeah, that's always kind of tweaks people's brains because their expectations it's S-O-U-L, which is somewhat implied. We originally started under the auspices of another charity on the downtown east side called United We Can, and they had a project called Save Our Living Environment, which they shortened, you know, the acronym being SOUL. We were under the auspices of that Save Our Living Environment. And so when our project grew beyond the mother charity and we formed our own charity, we kept the name, but we kept it as SOLE. So it's it has multiple meanings depending on how you.
And this is urban agriculture, and there's a lot of people who work for you who spend a lot of time walking the streets. So I guess
yes.
Maybe there's other meanings to it.
Many meanings, yeah. I mean, there are certainly a lot of layers to not only the name but the project itself.
Yes. So this is not just an urban farm. It's in kind of a special area. So can you describe
sure.
where your different bits and pieces of farmland are?
Yeah.
And what are the characteristics of this area?
Sure. Well, we operate on the downtown east side of Vancouver, which is kind of a notorious area for, it's about roughly about a 15 block, square block area, almost entirely inhabited by folks who are dealing with some form of long-term addiction, mental illness, and material poverty. It is, in fact, the poorest postal code in the entire country of Canada. And we specifically set this project up in that community, in that neighborhood. Our entire mandate and mission on the social front is to employ people from that community who previously were considered, as they say, hard to employ. And so we have set up a number of urban farms. These are not gardens, they're production farms on large parking lots in many cases, producing about 25 tons of food annually, which is considerable when you consider it's a lot of greens, and doing that with the hands of people who had previously not only no agricultural experience, but also struggled with many, many, and continue to other
right.
issues.
Right. So you've said that most of the people that you're hiring are addicted or have been addicted. Are there other characteristics? There's a lot of native people.
Yeah. I mean, on average over the years, I think roughly about 30% of our staff population are First Nations.
And that's in total in Canada, I think population's like 5% or something.
Yeah, so and well, you know, the downtown east side is considered to be, it's been termed the largest urban First Nations reserve in It's technically not a reserve,
right.
I guess, but in the world, I mean, the percentage of the people living in that neighborhood in particular who are from First Nations origins is quite high.
Yeah, I mean, I think homelessness in Canada is quite distinct from, say, in the United States because of the significant number of Native people who are homeless.
Yes.
I think in the United States there's a lot of veterans dealing with PTSD and other things who
That's
form
correct.
A significant number, so this is quite different. So how do you go about hiring somebody? How do you choose the people who might work out and the mm-hmm. people who won't work out?
Well, I mean, we don't hire on the basis of it's interesting. Our first priority, unlike most businesses, is to the benefit of the person we're employing first and foremost, and of course, you know, the operation has to continue and we have to pay the bills.
Right.
So we cannot accommodate the individuals who are really unable to function at all. For example, mm-hmm. we had a guy working with us the first year who had no control over his grip. So by the time a bunch of carrots or arugula or radishes made it to the box, they were kind of squeezed to a pulp.
I see.
And it was heartbreaking. I mean, we can't take folks who, they have to basically be able to function, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we are very much in the business of employing people for their benefit and hopefully, in the process, keeping the farm business going as well. We do have to perform. You know, there are days when there's 300 or 400 bunches of radishes or carrots or whatever that have to be harvested and delivered
right.
to restaurants, and we have to have people there who can do that. On the other hand, if someone doesn't show up for work, they don't lose their job. And if they fall off the wagon, they don't lose their job. And when they return to work, the question is not, where have you been? It's, how are you? That's a very
right.
different question. Yeah. So.
So where does the food go? You've mentioned restaurants. Are there markets
as
well?
Yeah, we sell to most of Vancouver's, you know, best-known restaurants and chefs. We also sell to farmers markets in Vancouver. We have a community support agriculture program, a program that membership families have memberships in the season. And we donate a certain percentage of food as well to local downtown Eastside kitchens, although, you know, we're not, our primary goal is to be able to generate enough income to make our payroll, so
right.
these are paid
right.
jobs, so we are in the business of trying to sell the food so that we can continue to hire our staff.
Right. Maybe we should talk about that, because you're kind of a charity and kind of not.
Yeah. Well, the charity, we are wholly owned by the registered charity called Cultivate Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And the Soul Food's entire goal and mandate is to fulfill the mission and the mandate of the charity. So we are really in service of the charity.
Right. So you would say employment is more important than the farming, but of course, without the farming, there would be no employment.
That's right. And, you know, we like to use the terms meaningful employment.
Mm-hmm.
We feel that farming is a very powerful way to help people get on their feet. It's an important set of skills that we're training, and it's provides benefits to the population we work with that go beyond what any kind of, you know, working in an office or a warehouse or something would provide. Just having your hands in living soil is proven to be beneficial to mental health.
I don't think you could find people all over the political spectrum who would say that work is really important to finding meaning in your life. Obviously, it
yes.
can't be the only thing. But, you know, sometimes these programs become very soul-destroying, produce
That's
very
right.
soul-destroying work. What are the aspects of farming to say, a drug or alcohol-addicted homeless person that could make an impact and improvement in their life?
Yeah, well, I mean, when a big piece of it is that when you have living things that depend on you every day for daily attention, when you have a community of a team and a community of farmers that depend on you and a community who's depending on the food that comes from those plants, when you know that you have to get up out of bed to go and take care of those things, that in itself is a powerful thing. As I mentioned, living soil, working with living soil is really, really amazing. The process of seeing seed emerge is absolutely incredible. I've seen it a million times over the last 40 years, and I still am in awe of that magic. These kinds of things, the ability to work outside, the physicality of the work, all of these things have enormous benefit that go beyond. In many cases, there are things going on that we cannot even see or articulate, but are having a positive effect on people's mental health and their desire to be there every day.
Right. So people feel that they're wanted, they're needed, and
Absolutely. Presumably
appreciated.
Yeah, there's a great, I mean, I will say there is a great sense of community with this project, and that has, for many of our staff, this is the only meaningful engagement of their lives. That's a remarkable thing to say, but it's true. And so we have people tell us without drama that, in their view, the only reason they're still alive is as a result of this job, and that, otherwise the choices are pretty limited,
I used to live in Vancouver, and I've been to that part of town a few times, not often. it's not really a tourist destination.
No.
To say the least, but the harshness of the environment, the sort of decayed urban infrastructure, the short-term hotels, the bars, it's a very cold and depressing environment. So having things growing in it seems it's very distinct. It's a real
contrast.
Yeah,
I mean, we are, we constantly, because there's so many people can walk by any of these farms, and they do. We're right as visible as you can imagine. There aren't, agriculture and food production is not normally, it's something that's done far from where people live and eat.
Right.
And the consequences of that have been quite negative. So for people to be able to visibly see, entire parking lot full of boxes full of food growing, and to take it a step further to actually participate in that process is really quite remarkable,
Yeah, well, let's talk about the support that you have. You say you sell to restaurants. Presumably, they're not just buying this food solely because it's cost-effective and available. They probably want this to succeed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very clear, and I wrote about this in the book, and I have said this many times. I feel very strongly that I don't want people to buy our food out of some sense of charity or because they believe in our mission or because of our social goals. That's wonderful that people support that, but I think first and foremost they have to buy the food because it's really good food.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, they should go elsewhere. We have a responsibility, in my view, to produce food at a quality level that is on par and on parity with other farms. It doesn't matter who we're employing. We have that obligation. And we hold ourselves to a very high standard. And in fact, the chefs that we deal with are, as I said, some of the better known in the city, and they love what we produce. And I think that's a real accomplishment.
Right.
We're not looking for on the food production front. We really demand of ourselves that we be working at a high level.
And, I mean, there are some advantages to urban agriculture. The time from picking the food to it being delivered to a market or a restaurant is probably a lot less than if it's picked miles away from Vancouver.
Right. Yeah, that is certainly a important.
And are you all organic?
We are indeed, yeah.
And that's kind of, that seems to me kind of ironic because you're actually growing this food on highly polluted land, but you're not actually growing it on the land.
No, we've developed a very innovative system, that box system, that isolates the growing medium from either contaminated land, which most urban land is, or pavement, and allows us to grow in boxes that we design. And so, we have to be responsible to the, the soil and the knowing that the products that are growing in that soil are growing in safe conditions. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, most cities anywhere in the world are now, most native soils in urban areas are now too contaminated to safely grow food in. And so we've had to come up with a strategy that allows us to address that.
Right. It also means that you can move your farm, which has had to happen because you don't actually have real control over the land that
That's
you're
correct.
Occupying.
Very high value land.
So if somebody decides to build condos on the parking lot, you're out of there.
We have to move.
Yes.
Yeah, the boxes are designed with forklift tabs and they're fully movable. And we are definitely at the whims of, Vancouver is one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive real estate market anywhere in North America. And some people say certainly one of the most expensive in the world, to have, it's remarkable to have a neighborhood which is the poorest existing side by side and within one of the wealthiest communities in the world.
All right. Can you illustrate some of those contrasts?
Yeah, I mean, it's, and I play with this quite a bit in the book. To have started this project, we had to raise a fair amount of money, and so I was reaching out to the wealthiest members of the community in order to support the poorest members of the community. We are constantly, we grow the food on these parking lots, the hands of people who would previously be considered, low lifers by most people who would see them on the street. Everybody makes judgments, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that food is then being sold to end up on the plates and the tables of, not only fine dining restaurants, but the farmers markets. And so there's this strange kind of, whether people realize it or not, if they're eating our food, they have essentially embodied the pieces of the downtown east side that they normally would not want to accept or participate in.
I mean, it is ironic. I mean, you have the people with a lot of money who may have helped contribute to this very unequal society that we live in, who are humans and want to reduce human suffering, which is presumably why a lot of people support you.
Yes, I mean, I think that, we have, as I said, the food production piece, which is, again, seeks to be high quality production, not, we're selling food and asking that people buy it because they like the food. And then we have our charitable arm, which we do have to, we generate about, roughly $250,000, $300,000 a year in earned revenue from products grown and sold. And then we have to essentially fundraise for at least that much again through our charity.
So it's about 50-50.
It's about 50-50. We would like to see it, obviously we'd love to see the earned revenue side go up and up, and we hope to do that, but by nature of the population who we are employing, I think we will always to some degree have our hands out, and that's just the reality. We are never going to operate on the same playing field as other farms, and as such we have to get some support.
Right. Have you had support from governments like city, provincial, federal governments?
Nothing from the federal government. Some early on, some support from the city of Vancouver. We have some leases with the city of Vancouver on some of our parcels of land. There's a pretty fair exchange going on there, even though we're not paying for the leased land. The the public relations benefit and the mission that we fulfill for the city, because urban agriculture is one of the top goals for Vancouver's Greenest City Action Plan.
Right.
And we fulfill 90% of the urban agriculture in the city.
Okay, well, that's, I guess that helps the city. You think they could do a little bit more.
Dramatically so, yeah.
I mean, are there people on city council in Vancouver who'd be just happy if you went away?
Well, you know, we're struggling at the moment, to be frank, because we we're losing the lease on our largest site, our headquarters site.
Mm-hmm.
And we're having great difficulty finding a new location, and the city has not necessarily, they've attempted to be helpful, but they're, I think that there's a big difference often and a big gap between the stated vision and goals at the high level of city government and the reality of what happens on the ground. And in our case, although urban agriculture is stated to be a very important priority, and we represent 90% of it in Vancouver, we don't always feel that we get the kind of support we need. And we pay quite dearly for the permits to use those sites, sometimes, $20,000, $30,000 to have achieved a single permit for one location.
To achieve the permit, so even though you're getting
just
a lease.
The various, environmental assessments and all the consultants and all that they require to,
Right. But one of the other economic benefits of what you're doing is surely the difference you're making in people's lives. I mean, a lot of money in Canada, the United States, other places is poured into trying to deal with drugs. We've mm-hmm. got policemen looking for drugs to try to intercept them. We have a health infrastructure and treatment systems and things like that. And a lot of it seems quite futile, especially the war on drugs. But can you describe, a case? Can you sort of illustrate what can happen with some of these addicts who get involved with the farm?
Yeah, well, first of all, a few years ago, Queen's University studied our project, and they have some pretty good protocols now. They determined that for every dollar we paid our staff, there was a $2.25 savings to the healthcare system, the legal system, the social assistance system, and to the environment. That's real money that the society as a whole, the government, would normally have to be paying for, that we are goals that we are achieving financially that are real, And so I think it's important, I always have to remind myself of that, because when I'm struggling as a farmer, and I am a commercial organic farmer by trade, that we're not meeting all of our financial goals through earned revenue, I have to remember the broader and the external benefits that we are providing to the society, And so I think that's important. I mean, the individual stories are amazing. I mean, we have people who are working with us, some of whom, maybe did not hold a job for 5, 6, 7 months, who've been employed with us now for almost 8 years.
You've had people since the beginning. You started
in
2010?
Yes, we have a few, right, since the beginning. That's unheard of in most projects like this. We have seen dramatic results in certain individuals' lives, things that have gone way beyond my expectations. One person in particular who started with us very early on, a hardcore crack addict, and now is one of our supervisors, who's really an amazing farm worker, very talented, very gotten his life together, takes care of his kids, fully employed. It's really awesome, off of social assistance.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's the fact that you, from a balance sheet perspective, lose money. It has to be subsidized by charity is kind of losing sight of the immense amount of money, even in America, where there's no government healthcare system, universal government healthcare system. There's a huge amount of money goes into dealing with drug problems.
Mm-hmm.
Drug addicts showing up at the emergency room have to be treated. They're thrown in jail. They're all incredibly expensive
That's
ways
right.
to deal with drug addiction, and they're all incredibly ineffective.
They are incredibly ineffective, and the pretty much every study that's ever been done, well, certainly the extreme end of it is the so-called war on drugs, which was an unbelievable source of just horrendous suffering.
Still is.
It still is.
Not so much. But...
And all the way down to the community level where, as you say, the cost to the healthcare system and the legal system, et cetera, is just, it's absurd. And this is for something that is really a health issue. It's not a criminal or legal issue. And it should be treated as a health issue.
Yes, but I think I'm not even 100% convinced about the medical model, because that sort of encourages a degree of dependence.
That's right. Yeah.
As opposed to independence.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, we're not, I'm very clear in the book, and I probably say this several times in the book, that, you know, we are not at Soul Food, addiction experts. We're not social workers. We're not psychologists. What we've done is unbelievably simple and yet incredibly profound. And it's really just simply been to give people a reason to get out of bed every day and a community of people to work with and things that depended on them, you know, and a living system to participate in. And, you know, that has been, I mean, there's this incredible crisis around opioid addiction throughout North America, and everyone grappling to try to figure out what to do. And really, it's quite simple. Why does this exist? It exists because people do not feel a sense of purpose, a sense of belonging, a sense of meaning. They do not have the kinds of meaningful engagements in their lives that keep them feeling needed, wanted, and participants in the world. And I think, you know, I hate to simplify this, because it's, I know it's not, you know, entirely as I described, but we have seen amazing things as a result of such a simple solution. You know?
Mm-hmm. Have people talked about, have some of your workers talked about their earlier lives and some of the traumas or
yes.
other things that have...
Yeah, I mean, again, in the book I tell the story of about seven or eight of our staff, and they all agreed to participate in some pretty intimate interviews that I mm-hmm. did, and those stories are there, and they're not easy stories to read in many cases. I mean, these are folks who've had, you know, for a lot of folks, the trauma started very early, you
mm-hmm.
know, and especially for the folks we're dealing with, it was significant. And so they're carrying that around, and of course that plays out. And so those stories are described. I mean, I'm not going to get into detail on that during this interview, but certainly...
Well, people can read
people want to read the book, that's great.
Yeah.
But, you know, they also tell the story of, you know, how the incredible perseverance that they have demonstrated and courage to pick themselves up and try to, you know, work with what they've been given, and their participation in this project has been amazing. That's what's made this a success, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, again, if you walk down the street on the downtown east side, even in broad daylight, I mean, you would encounter people on the sidewalk with a needle in their arm, or somebody, mm-hmm. you know, pirouetting in the middle of the street. You know, it is, for most of us, a sight that brings up judgments, you know. And
right.
those are the people we work with. And when you get to know them, you realize that these are folks who have incredible intelligence and creativity and the desire to do something really meaningful in their lives. And that's all we've done. We've provided that opportunity.
Right. And, I mean, it is difficult for people who want to get back on their feet if they're still struggling with addiction. In a normal job, the first time you don't show up for work because
that's right.
you're stoned, you're done, right?
You're done. Yeah, that's not our model. I mean, if we did that, we would have no staff. And so we have to, you know, essentially we have to assume, as we do every day, that there are going to be people who either don't show up or who are not in a state where they can, you know, function well. And so we have to always cover ourselves, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because you you want to help these people, but you want to run an operating farm. And could you also say that if you turned towards more of a charitable model where your goal is solely to help people, that you would be less effective?
Yeah, I mean, I've had one of our funders has asked me, and, you know, it's an interesting question, is why don't you just give them the money? You know? I said, yeah, I mean, on some, if you're just looking at this from an economics perspective, yeah, I could just probably raise money and hand it out. But
that, right.
But, you know, he knows, and I know that that's not what we're doing, and the benefit of what we're doing is, in fact, inherent in the work itself and in the atmosphere and the environment that those farms and gardens represent. And so, yeah, we, while this is not, as I said, you know, on the level of the kind of just straightforward production commercial agriculture in terms of its economic model, its benefits are in my mind, equal if not greater, you know. So they're not as easy to measure.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting hybrid, because if you ran just a purely commercial operation where your aim is to make money growing food in the city, you wouldn't be hiring
exactly
people.
Yeah, and that's the thing, you know, look, as a farmer, I, you know, I've struggled with that. And to be honest with you, the two goals, our social goal and our agricultural one, often rub up against each other. You know, they are not always in harmony and sync, because, again, as you said, if we were going to just run an urban farm, we'd hire people with the skills and the ability to show up.
Right.
And so it's this is a constant source of tension, but it's one that we, in some ways, we welcome. It keeps us honest, and we always are having to, every day, we have to approach our work with a beginner's mind. We have to not come with any preconceptions, because you never know what you're going to encounter.
Right. You probably had some really bad days where you...
Oh, there are bad days. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So... how do you deal with the agricultural aspect of this? You have soil in a box. I mean, how do you keep that soil healthy? How do you keep pests away? Things like that.
Yeah, I mean, look, the truth is that you can put the best, most biologically diverse, fertile soil into a container, a box, and over, you know, 6 months or a year of growing in it, you begin to see it, its organic matter, its biological integrity beginning to degrade. You don't have the benefit of this vast reservoir of interrelationships, interconnections, mm-hmm. biologically that exist in an open field, more traditional agricultural situation. So
right.
It requires us to have been very creative and innovative in order to keep those elements active and dynamic. So, you know, everything from compost teas to worm castings, whatever we can do to constantly inject biology into those soils, we have to do it. It's challenging, you know.
And you do it without...
it's all done organically. We don't use any, you know. Yeah, I mean, we are not certified organic, but we use... know, stringent organic practices, and we are constantly searching for ways to do it better. I mean, this is a work in progress.
Right. I mean, you've definitely been doing this for a long time. Do you have a lot of pest problems, and how do you deal with that?
Very few pest problems. I mean, you know, similar to what I do in my open field farming systems, you know, if you have a pest or disease issue, it's most likely can be tied to something more fundamental that's wrong with the mm-hmm. system, you know. So generally, we build positive plant health through building soil, healthy soil, you know. When the foundation, the soil, is in good heart and healthy, and when the plants are planted at the right time of year and the conditions are right atmospherically and climatically, et cetera, you rarely have significant pest or disease issues. Pests and disease respond to plants that are out of balance, okay, mm-hmm. and animals that are out of balance. That's and it's true with us as humans as well. You know, we're not, the world is full of all kinds of potential harmful invading forces, but personal health is really about maintaining, sleeping well and eating well and taking
right.
care of yourself. And when you are taking care of yourself, there's very little that can affect you. Obviously, you could break your leg or fall out of the window or something.
Well, I mean, that can be the start. Yeah, I mean, if we're going to human health, but that's often the start of a decline, right? Like if you don't know how to pick up the pieces when something goes terribly wrong. I mean, Vancouver is a pretty mild climate. It's got a good amount of water. The temperatures in the summer are not too hot and the winter is not too cold. But have you had some weather events that have proved particularly challenging?
This past winter was really, it was truly, it was, I've been here for 16 years and never seen a winter like we had this past one. It was a real winter. Lots of snow and very cold temperatures and sustained over a long period of time. And so, many of our, we do a fair amount of winter cropping and we lost a lot of stuff, it's hard to be whining, complaining about that to with listeners that might be in, North Dakota or Saskatchewan or something.
Right. Well,
they're not going to have much. They will not express much sympathy, I'm sure. But for coastal British Columbia, it was harsh. And we do get sustained hot, dry periods. We find that on the pavement, things are much hotter. Things dry out faster.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yes, and now you have an orchard.
We have. Yeah, we've got a full, producing, amazing orchard, 500 some trees, persimmons and figs and quince, and unusual varieties of apple, pear, cherry, plum. We had a few lemons. They have, because we don't have the ability to protect them as well in the winter, they're no longer around. Persimmons, producing persimmons, it's pretty amazing.
That seems pretty.
So that's been a really amazing part of the operation that I really like.
These seem like foods that would be really picked up by restaurants, right? Exotic fruits.
That's right. And it's also the environment in that orchard, because it's, first of all, we're taking advantage of something that, there's not much lateral space in the city that's available and affordable, but there is vertical space. So we've got these, 20-foot tall trees that are, producing and also creating shade and habitat for birds and beneficial insects. It's quite remarkable to be in that space in the middle of the city at one of the busiest corners in the city. You feel like you could be anywhere. It's a special spot. Yeah.
Do you think there would be a possibility to actually farm in soil in the city, or are the challenges, the environmental challenges, just too great?
Yeah, I think for the most part we have given up on that possibility. I think it's really rare to find a piece of land, even if it's even a front or backyard, even a schoolyard that's totally safe. I think that, I'm sure there are, certainly I know there are places that would be, but I would be very concerned, even though, you'd have to do quite a sophisticated testing program to make sure that you have covered an entire area and make sure that there are
right.
no, because, urban areas are just known to have, there could be a pocket of something.
Right. You don't know if the school was built on what was formerly a gas station and there's actually a sort of a pool of petrochemicals under the ground.
That's a fairly radical, but that's possible. Things like that have happened, I'm sure.
Well, I live in Calgary, as you know, and I lived in a neighborhood on one side of the river, and they dug up one of the streets to put in a new water main, and they started to get the smell of creosote. And there used to be a factory across the river.
Yeah.
And the creosote, the telephone poles, would just drip on the ground.
Oh,
the creosote would soak into the soil. And the power of the river going in one direction drove the creosote under the river at right angles and up on the other side.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. I mean,
that's some serious nasty stuff, too.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So that caused, they still haven't cleaned up the, that drove them to actually start cleaning up the creosote plant, which had basically been sitting there for 30, 40 years on the side of the river as just an empty lot that nobody wanted to use, but nobody really recognized how dangerous it was.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, that's, I think the, you start digging into the history of most urban areas, I would have to say there probably is not a city in the world that does not have layers of industrial waste and toxic materials.
Right,
and residues.
Right.
You know, so, yeah.
So to go back a little bit into your earlier life, you started organic agriculture in the 1970s, is that correct?
Well, I didn't start organic agriculture.
I mean, you started doing it yourself.
Yeah, I started doing it in the early 1970s, that's correct. I would probably say that I was one of the early pioneers of the movement in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And
what drove you in that direction?
Well, you know, it's interesting. As a young man, I looked around at the world and I thought to myself, what could I possibly do as a livelihood, a profession that would not involve sucking the life out of the world, which I saw a lot of things people were doing were mm-hmm. doing exactly that. And farming kind of revealed itself to me just by chance. I had family history in that, but it had skipped a generation. And you know, I ended up by chance involved with some really fascinating, diverse organic agricultural operations, and one thing led to the next. And you know, there I was, really at the age of 18, managing one of the largest and earliest organic orchards in the U.S. at the time. I knew nothing, but I had to figure it out.
And probably nobody believed that it could possibly succeed.
Yeah, there was certainly at that time a lot of naysayers, and certainly even those that believed in it assumed that the products from organic farms would look terrible. They'd be full of holes and misshapen, mm-hmm. and of course, you know, it took us a number of years to prove that actually they can be cosmetically as beautiful, if not more beautiful, than their conventional counterparts, and that production levels can be equal, if not better, and that in the end, the soils and the environment where these products are being grown are sustaining themselves and producing food that's certainly a lot better for us and the environment. So this took a while to, you know, we had a lot to overcome in those early days.
I mean, going from whether it's plausible at all to that it might actually be better than the model that's used.
It's a little wacky for anyone who knows anything about history. I mean, really, the conventional system, the industrial system of agriculture, is actually the new thing. It's only been around since World War I and World War II. You know, we essentially took the technology of two world wars and applied them to peacetime role in food production. You know, nitrates mm-hmm. that were originally used for building bombs, and traction from tanks and tractors, herbicides, all those things came out of wartime technology. So really, prior to World War I, you know, everybody was farming organically. This was not mm-hmm. some sort of. So we have, humans have a much longer history in organic farming systems than we do in the more conventional industrial systems. And all we did in the early 70s and 60s was to rediscover those ancient systems and to meld them with some modern techniques and try to make it more efficient and productive and. So, yeah.
Yeah. Also, I mean, one of the characteristics of if I can call it modern agriculture, non-organic agriculture, is it also focuses on huge amounts of land given to producing monocultures, basically producing one crop.
Yeah.
In very large quantities and very, very consistent, like fields of wheat, which are just a commodity. Every grain of wheat should be basically the same as every other. Whereas diversity is not really valued in that,
right.
in that model.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're right, and there are many very successful, extremely large organic commodity producers. But they figured out that very intentional crop rotation programs, interplantings, enormous attention to soil, and the encouragement of diversity and biodiversity are really important. I mean, I know people are growing thousands of acres of organic grain and doing it quite successfully, mm-hmm. but their approach to the systems that they're using is incredibly creative and is really mimicking the way nature would normally do it.
Right. They can't end up, to me, I'm thinking of like a microbrewery that starts with a couple of guys in the basement and gets more and more successful, could easily end up becoming another Coors if they don't watch what they're doing, right? If production costs are driven down and quantity becomes the
right.
only thing that you want, you pretty
that's
much
right.
end up being what you didn't want to be.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it really takes, over the years, there was has been a period of time where larger producers, conventional producers, saw some of the success that organic producers were having and decided to make the switch primarily for economic reasons. In the end, I think you'd have to say that most people who have chosen to farm organically have had to evolve their own internal thinking their understanding of how things work, because if it's just an economic drive, you're not going to succeed. You have to believe in it. You have to understand how biological systems work, and you have to recognize yourself as a participant, not the general in the field, directing the army.
It's a different
way of thinking. You know?
Yeah, right, because modern agriculture is all about total control of
exactly.
everything,
and
organic agriculture is more
Participation, cooperation. Yeah.
So if people are interested in replicating your success, like there are other places where there's some urban agriculture, but like what should people take into consideration, whether
yeah.
it's just pure urban agriculture or if people would want to do something similar to what you're doing as sort of having social goals as well?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, I'm very careful not to claim success because, it's what we do is constantly evolving and changing. And in fact, if you read the Street Farm book, you'll see that I spend a fair amount of time talking about where we've fallen short, because I think that's more informative and helpful to people than just me talking about our successes. And so when we're talking about the human aspect of what we're doing, success is a relative term. You just have to, it's a daily thing. Were we successful today? And what will be success tomorrow? We don't know.
Well, it's kind of like the AA model, right?
It's a daily thing.
If you can get through today,
right,
tomorrow,
exactly.
you can worry about tomorrow.
Yeah. So, I think that, of course, somewhat shamelessly and also to benefit the work that we're doing, the book is a great way to immerse yourself in, what we've done, and also there's quite a bit of material in there on how we did it and, some general principles and ideas in terms of how people might consider starting, So it's not a how-to book per se, but there's a lot in there that people can bite into that would help them consider these ideas for other places. People can check our website, which is soulfoodfarms.com, and that's SOLE.
Right.
They can go to the publisher's website, where there's a lot of information on there, Chelsea Green, Chelsea Green, .com. They can go to michaelableman.com, that's ABLEMAN. And there's a lot of resources and information on all those sites, michaelableman.com, soulfoodfarms.com, or Chelsea Green as the publisher. So, I think that, it's really what's wonderful about this is that the basic principles that we have used and considered are applicable anywhere. The particularities of how they're applied can be and I think should be adjusted for, you know, where you are, you know, and who you're dealing with.
Have there been people who've
replicated this?
Or not replicated, but sort of...
Mm-hmm. Lots.
Yes?
I mean, lots of people who come, and we have a gazillion visitors from all over the world, actually. And I don't know what people do with what they walk away with. It's, you know, I've spent a lifetime, you know, writing books and out there speaking and trying to inspire people, and you're never quite sure what seed got planted and how it evolved, but you have to disattach yourself from that. So, I would hope that the result has been that people have started some similar things. You know?
Yeah, I've certainly heard a lot about urban agriculture, but I haven't dug into it quite so deeply.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I started the Center for Urban Agriculture in the early 1980s. In those days, when you used the words urban and agriculture in the same sentence, you were looked at kind of strangely, like that didn't make sense. You know,
mm-hmm.
Now, of course, there's a big movement and people understand those terms, you know, to some degree. So.
Well, I mean, I guess it's one of the good things about the post-industrial cities like Detroit, that there's
a
lot of land.
They got a lot of land.
It's now open.
they have a lot of land.
What seemed impossible, you know, at the height of manufacturing, when the cities were packed with people and factories and houses, is completely different now.
No, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
And if people want to help Soul Food Farms, what are the best ways they can do that?
Well, you know, we, of course, through our charity, we would more than welcome any charitable donations that people would like to make, and they can do that through our website, again, Soul Food, S-O-L-E, foodfarms.com.
Mm-hmm.
They could also... you know, contact me through my website if necessary, michaelabelman.com, if that would be easier for them. And we can direct them. And if people have any ideas that they'd like to share or suggestions as to who might be able to help us out, we're always interested in that.
Are there opportunities for volunteers?
We do some of that on a limited basis because we're very careful not to be taking work away from the people we are trying to employ, and so if we bring in a lot of volunteers, it means less work for our staff. And
right.
We do annually. We take a few apprentices on over there. It's a paid internship, and but again, most of our staffing is really focused on people from the downtown east side.
Mm-hmm. And your farm on Salt Spring Island, right?
Foxglove Farm. Yeah, that's right. That's the other. People can look that up, Foxglove Farm, BC.com. It's a 120-acre farm on the island. We run some education programs. We have wonderful lodging in the summer for a lot of families come and park themselves in one of our cottages or cabins, and they eat from the fields. We deliver baskets of food to their rooms, and we're surrounded by hundreds of acres of protected land, and it's a beautiful spot. And of course, Salt Spring is a wonderful place. So,
I think a lot of people would want to know how you manage to do everything that you do.
Well, at the moment, I'm not sure that I am able. I am actually managing it. It's been. I turned 62. I'll be 63 this summer, and I am, in fact, I have a lot of energy, but I'm rethinking and refocusing by the day, because I do work a lot.
Yes. Well, I mean, if something like this is going to be sustainable, there has to be a transition plan.
That's
from
right.
One
exactly.
person to the next.
You better believe it, yeah.
Which is another aspect. Yeah. Well, finally, there is an election happening in your province.
Right.
Right now with the, I guess I'd consider the parties, there's the crony capitalist liberals, the lukewarm socialist NDP, and the dreamers, the Greens.
Good description.
Is that good? So if you had a message to the new government on any thing that you've learned from Soul Food Farms, what would it be?
Well, two things. I've been a very close observer, being both American and Canadian, of the recent U.S. elections. It was remarkable to me to that not once during any of the debates or questions or discussions did either presidential candidate talk about food or agriculture, which, by the way, I believe is still kind of fundamental to our lives.
I like to eat.
especially in a nation like the U.S. that was founded on Jeffersonian and agrarian principles. That's all but gone, you know. And here in Canada, I would say that to some degree that's the same. I mean, it's not a topic that candidates talk about because they're not involved with it, and yet it's really absolutely and fundamentally critical to all of our well-being. You know, certainly if big issues around health care and the cost of health care, both in the U.S. and Canada, certainly a bigger issue in the U.S., but we have, I believe that food is an important piece of that. And I think that when we're looking at those populations who are underserved, such as the ones people we work with on the Downtown East Side, and that population exists across Canada, I think we have a responsibility to be thinking out of the box and creatively about how to have a more equanimous and equal society, and how to reach out to folks who maybe need some help, and how to do it in a way that is not strictly following the more traditional, not terribly successful charitable model that we have from the past, you know.
Right. Well, the government models and the charity models have all seems to have failed on a lot of
issues. I think we need to you know, I think that, Soul Food is one model, but I think that, candidates tend to speak to those they know either have the money that are going to support them or are going to be able to have the ability to vote,
right,
and will be there. And I think a lot of people fall through the cracks. And I think that someone who reaches political office is responsible not just to those who supported them, but to everyone in that society. And that's not been the way it works. And so I feel like to have a tiny organization like Soul Food doing what really is the society's responsibility as a whole is not right. This is everybody should be participating in the work that we do, in
yes.
their own way. So.
Well, thank you. That's a good note to end on.
Yep.
So thank you very much for
joining
me. Yeah,
thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
And I will send you a link to the MP3 podcast
Excellent.
After it airs.
Okay. Hey, thanks so much.
Okay, goodbye.
All the best. Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 142 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, a question, or a suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. You can commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.